Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Thomas Keels. He's the author of Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City. Susan Lewis looks at a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art that explores the work of Antonio Mancini, a contemporary of the Impressionists who forged a style all his own. Nicholas McGeegan talks us through a program that features works by Haydn and Mozart that he's been conducting with the Philadelphia Orchestra this week. And Jason Pfeiffer explores what it takes to start a theatre company in the Philadelphia region. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Thomas Keels received an undergraduate degree in history, which he then, in his own words, ignored for 20 years while he forged a career in the commercial world. About 15 years ago, he began writing articles on local history for the Chestnut Hill local newspaper. These features ended up in a 2002 book on the history of that area called Chestnut Hill. The following year, Keels' Philadelphia Graveyards and Cemeteries was published. Thomas Keels' latest work, Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, tells the stories of three centuries of now vanished buildings in the Philadelphia region. Some of these disappeared due to lack of upkeep, others because of redundant usage, and some, like the Benjamin Rush Birthplace in northeast Philadelphia, due to bureaucratic incompetence. Keels tells these stories in an informative and often entertaining style, and the book is an engaging read for both the studious and the merely curious. In 2006, a friend gave Thomas Keels a copy of Lost New York, Nathan Silver's much-acclaimed 1968 history of that city's many extant and extinct architectural treasures. This inspired Keels to begin researching Philadelphia's history of historic preservation. When Thomas Keels came into our studios recently, I first asked him if he felt Philadelphia was more or less careful than other cities when it comes to preserving its architectural heritage.
Compared to many other cities, we are very good at historic preservation, thanks to Society Hill and to our historic buildings like Independence Hall. We do have one of the greatest collections of 18th century buildings in America. We are also, according to architectural historian George Thomas, one of the top five American cities when it comes to 19th century architecture. But this seems to give everybody the false impression that Philadelphia is preserved in amber, that we have never destroyed a single building ever. And in truth, we have destroyed as many great buildings by great architects as any world-class city.
Not a great boast. We're world-class at destroying our city.
No, better than most. But we really have destroyed an incredible number of buildings, some great, some not so great, but which had their own particular meaning and value. But since we were the center of American architecture for close to 150 years, people like Robert Smith, John Haviland, Benjamin Latrobe, leading up to Frank Furness and then all the way up to, of course, Venturi and Scott Brown, have made Philadelphia their home. And many of these buildings were demolished over the course of the years. Part of it was due to Philadelphia's phenomenal growth. We grew from a city of a few thousand people to a city of nearly 2 million from 1750 to 1950. With that kind of growth and outward dynamic, it's inevitable the buildings are going to get destroyed.
There are some doozies in here, though. You mentioned Robert Smith, and I guess the building that most Philadelphians will be aware of that no longer exists, indeed there are no representations or photographs or paintings or anything, is Benjamin Franklin's home on Market Street.
That's correct. Part of it is because it was not a remarkable building. It was not a Mount Vernon. It was not a Monticello. Franklin was an urban man. He wanted to be close to Market Street. He wanted to be close to his printing office. And so his building was a comfortable but fairly modest 3.5-story brick house with outbuildings, dependencies, etc., in a courtyard just off of Market Street. He was very comfortable there.
And he had his bells and whistles there, which I guess would have made it interesting, all these extraction systems and lightning rods and various different sewage systems that were very novel for their time.
Evidently, it was cutting edge for the 1780s. He, of course, was an incredible inventor, so you did have lightning rods. But you also had little things like perhaps the first book hook in America. He had his library off of his bedroom, and he may have been the person who invented the device that the sort of mechanical arm that you use to pull books off a top shelf. Several visitors to his house remarked on what a unique and interesting invention this was. But after he died, the property went to his daughter and son-in-law, and then to their descendants, and by the early 1800s, Lower Market Street was very busy, very commercial, very built up. There was really no escaping the smells and the sounds of the market and the nearby commercial concerns. So they sold the house, and it was torn down, and Oriana Street was run through. As you said, when the Independence National Historical Park tried to restore the house in the years leading up to the bicentennial, they realized they had no good representation of the house. Evidently, there was one painting by James Thackera that had belonged to a Franklin descendant that had just disappeared around 1948. So although they were able to completely restore the buildings on Market Street, the printing office, mm-hmm. the post office, etc., they finally decided to turn the project over to Venturi and Rauch, who basically built the ghost houses that we see. They knew the general dimensions. They knew there was a chimney here. They knew the kitchen was here. But they put these wonderful white steel ghost structures up. And, of course, if you've been there, you know that you can look through these portholes and see the excavations, see the ruins of the foundations of the kitchen, of the privy pits and things like that. So you have a general idea of what the house was, but nobody really knows for sure.
This would be one of the more obvious buildings that no longer exists that many residents of this region will be aware of. But one that many people wouldn't be aware of was the Benjamin Rush birthplace, which was in northeast Philadelphia and was demolished by accident?
By accident. Unfortunately, this is one of several cases of political disconnect that occurs in the book. The Benjamin Rush birthplace was this old stone farmhouse, nothing spectacular, but a beautiful old house where Benjamin Rush, doctor, signer of the Declaration of Independence, was born early in the 18th century. And he returned to the house many times during his life. He once wrote his friend John Adams about a visit to the house just before he died, seeing his father's initials carved in one of the doorposts. The house survived for many years after that. It was way up near the Byberry area of northeast Philadelphia, an area that stayed fairly rural until late. But by the 1960s, it had become very run down. Local historical groups were trying to save the house, make it into a shrine to Rush. It was supposedly protected by the Philadelphia Historical Commission. Unfortunately, nobody bothered telling the Department of Licenses and Inspection, who one day in the 1960s knocked it down. It was sort of like, oops, sorry about that. They did save most of the pieces. They were put in storage at the old Byberry Hospital. And I believe that a citizens group is now trying to raise money to have the house restored in some aspect. I have no idea how much of it actually survived.
And what's happened to the land that it existed on?
It is now part of a local park, I believe. I'm not sure if it's part of Benjamin Rush Park, which is way up in the northeastern end of the city, but I believe that the land is still open. Whether or not they would build it on that land or build it in a more protected environment, I don't know.
But the potential is possibly still there for this building to exist again in its original location.
Possible, yes. Probable, no.
Thomas Keels, his latest work, Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, is out now on the Temple University Press imprint. Keels will speak at the Central Branch of the Free Library of Philadelphia at 19th and Vine Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7 p.m.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Although much celebrated at the turn of the century, by the early 1900s, Antonio Mancini was all but forgotten by the art world. Now a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, prompted by a large gift from a collector, surveys the achievements of this Italian master. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers why Mancini fell off the map and what factors make a great artist famous.
Antonio Mancini's large oil paintings in some ways recall masters like Rembrandt, realistic figures with intense highlights plunging into shadows. Yet Mancini's style and technique were anything but traditional. Colors, often bright and bold, were thickly swabbed and globbed onto the canvas. In some paintings, he incorporated bits of glass, metal foil, or other materials.
He's an artist who really has one foot in the world of the old masters and one foot in the world of modern painting.
Ulrich Hiesinger is guest curator for this new show at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and a key player in the matchmaking process that led to it. Hiesinger was a longtime friend of the late art dealer and collector Vance Jordan and was named artistic director of Jordan's estate, which included 15 major works by Mancini. Antonio Mancini is no household name, even in museum circles. Joe Rischel, the museum's senior curator of European painting, says the acquisition of these works was more serendipitous than planned.
Ulrich was charged by the terms of Mr. Jordan's will to go out with the understanding that these would be given to an institution, a major U.S. institution, if they agreed to do a show putting these objects in proper context and do a publication around them.
The museum does not ordinarily like to accept gifts with conditions, says Associate Director for Collections Alice Beamsterfer. When a gift is proposed, there is a multi-step evaluation procedure, beginning with an individual curator and ending with the approval, or not, of the full board of trustees.
The process is very intensive because we're making a huge commitment.
The commitment in this case was deemed appropriate in light of the significance of the gift.
I think what was compelling about this gift was, first of all, the importance of Mancini as a kind of neglected figure, and also the fact that Vance Jordan had such a nice concentration of his work.
Aware that it was in competition with other institutions, Rischel says the museum made a strong case because while Philadelphia had no other Mancinis, it did have other paintings that could provide a rich context for his work.
Be they Swedish, German, Dutch, French, or in the middle of it all, Sargent.
John Singer Sargent, highly renowned in Europe, less well known in his own country, would turn out to be a major factor in Mancini's later success. Meanwhile, Mancini was forging his own path, pursuing il vero, the truth. Mancini was never part of any movement or school, says Ulrich Hiesinger, although he was aware of the trends of the time.
For instance, in the 1870s, he was in Paris. He knew Degas and Manet and so forth and was introduced around to virtually everyone. And yet he stayed very stubbornly resistant to any influence from them.
Instead, Mancini, guided by the old masters of his schooling, pursued his own vision, shaped in part by his humble background and hard times. Born in Rome in 1852, Antonio Mancini and his family moved to Naples when he was 12, where he studied at the city's Institute of Fine Arts. He produced his first major oil painting at 16, the over 6-foot-high work, Street Urchin, the beginning of a line of paintings that Joe Rischel says demonstrates one of Mancini's distinctive contributions to the art of the time.
It's one thing to paint poverty, it's another thing to paint it from the inside, the lost ones, those urchins that he paints. And they're heartbreakers, they really are, and they're meant to be. And it's not voyeuristic or anything, it's a projection on his part. He is one of them.
This early period culminated with a painting of a boy in silver, gold, and white circus costume, his arms folded, a thoughtful expression on his face. Ulrich Hiesinger says this painting, now a part of the Philadelphia Museum's collection, is the most famous of his Neapolitan works.
It's called Il Saltimbanco. There was a traveling circus called the Cirque Jouyon, and they actually had street shows as well as tent shows. So Mancini developed a number of subjects from his encounter with this circus world.
Mancini made several trips to Paris, where he exhibited this and other work, but was disappointed in his reception there. Eventually, he left, even painting a picture called Adieu Paris.
He said, I had to flee from working for the Paris dealers. He felt himself threatened and compromised by the kind of work he felt he had to do in order to earn a living. That's the picture, I think, that really encapsulates that. He was trying something to please a public, an imagined public, with a kind of work that he wasn't comfortable with.
Back in Naples, he was institutionalized in a mental hospital for 4 months. Shortly afterwards, he moved to Rome, where he began experimenting with different techniques. One was the use of what he called a graticola, a wooden-framed grid of threads or wires that he would set up in front of his subject and on his canvas as well. Although he said it was an aid to perspective, he would also sometimes paint through the grid, which would leave marks on the canvas. But both Rischel and Hiesinger say that the technique that set him apart from traditional gentility was not this, but the bold way in which he applied paint.
The amazing freedom and audacity with which he puts on these huge amounts of paint onto his surfaces, and how they somehow fuse together into very powerful images and very, very convincing and moving images.
Look at those surfaces. There's nothing suave and buttery about these. No, these are in-your-facey kind of thing, and a little crazy. It made people terribly nervous to have their portrait done by him, because he would leap around and jab the canvas and slam it on.
In the late 1800s, Mancini began to attract the attention of American dealers and investors, thanks to the continued support of John Singer Sargent. His work appeared in major exhibitions in Venice, Rome, and Naples. In 1929, the year before he died, the Italian government named him Accademico d'Italia, the country's highest civil honor for artists and intellectuals. This show of more than 40 of the over 2,000 works Mancini created ranges from large formal portraits to a number of self-portraits, to figures in casual moments, to items of dinner dishware, which on closer inspection reveal greater meaning. Mancini's late-life success came in large part from the support of private collectors and dealers, who Joe Rischel says play a huge role in the fate of an artist, particularly in the case of someone bucking established trends.
For if you are not within a salon in Paris or Royal Academy in London, if you don't have that institutional protection, you're even more dependent. I mean, then as now, you can paint all you want, but you have to find a conduit of that out into the world.
While private dealers eventually enabled Mancini to thrive, it is institutional support that keeps work in the public eye for generations to come. And so a gift like this from Vance Jordan may be a triple blessing. It enriches the collections of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, gives a neglected artistic master his due, and gives wider public exposure to perhaps one of the most underrated talents of the 19th century.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Antonio Mancini, 19th century Italian master, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art through January 20th. Nicholas McGeegan is renowned not just for his work as a conductor, but also for his special talent for talking about music. His uncomplicated, witty discourses on the works of the great composers have made him a popular host for educational performances, and along with Philadelphia Orchestra music animateur Thomas Cabanis, he gave a concert earlier this week called Hide and Seek. This was part of a week-long series of performances conducted by McGeegan, featuring Schubert's overture in C major in the Italian style, Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21 with Stephen Hoff, excerpts from Mozart's Idomeneo and Haydn's Symphony No. 100.
Haydn, when he was in his 60s, was invited to London. This was not a very easy journey to make in the 1790s because the French Revolution had just occurred. And even though Haydn was immensely popular in France, he was technically an enemy composer, not that an enemy combatant. And it's doubtful that he would have made it. So he had to take a very circuitous route to get to the Channel and then take a boat across to London, which he hated. And he was no sooner in London, he gave some concerts, and he was the belle of the ball, or the beau of the ball, I should say. Everybody absolutely loved him personally, adored his music, and he wrote really an awful lot of music in the years that he was there. The 12 symphonies that are known collectively as the Salomon Symphonies, he wrote a concertante, he wrote an opera, which was never performed, funny enough, until the 1950s. And many of these symphonies have names. The Surprise is one of the most famous, the London Symphony, although they're all London symphonies, and one of my favourites, the Military, which is called that because it has these extra percussion instruments in the slow movement and the last movement, but also just in the slow movement, there's a huge trumpet fanfare. Curiously enough, for the second trumpet, not the first one, followed by a great roll of all the percussion instruments. And then in the last movement, which is a very frolicsome presto, you just when you think it can't get any more silly than it actually is, all the percussion come in again to give it a rousing finale. Haydn and Mozart were tremendous friends, and it was a complete mutual admiration society. Haydn said to Mozart's father, I think he said something like, before God, this is the greatest musician I've ever met or am ever likely to meet, and the greatest one in the world. And Mozart really felt the same about Haydn. He learnt an awful lot from him.
Nicholas McGeegan. The final in a week-long series of concerts he conducts featuring works by Schubert, Mozart and Haydn is this evening at 8 at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall. In 2001, the Theatre Alliance of Greater Philadelphia listed nearly 60 members. Today, that list includes well over 100 theatres, proof that the Philadelphia theatre industry has seen tremendous growth in the last several years. Now, as part of a continuing series about what it takes to bring theatre to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer looks into what might account for this expansion and what's involved in starting a new company.
Theater has long been a part of Philadelphia's cultural life. The Walnut Street Theater in Center City bills itself as America's oldest theater, and it has indeed been in continuous operation since 1809. For years, the city was known as a tryout town for Broadway shows. Then, in the 1970s and 80s, companies like the Philadelphia Theater Company, the Wilma, People's Light, and the Arden Theater came along. Professional theater had undoubtedly arrived, but it wasn't until the late 90s and early 2000s that theater in the area really started to flourish. This can be attributed to a variety of factors. Relative to other East Coast cities, Philadelphia was a more affordable place in which to live and rent space. There was strong support from local foundations, not too much competition, and as companies quickly discovered, a hungry audience. According to Gregory Scott Campbell, founder and artistic director of the Luna Theater Company, the growth of the annual Philadelphia Fringe Festival was also a big factor, as the two-week event was open to anyone who had the gumption to fund and present their own show.
A lot of people will take a chance on this. It's low risk. You get a lot of promotion. And if you do well, hopefully, you do another.
In conjunction with a Fringe Festival show, Campbell started his Luna Theater in 2002. As a business owner, he says he didn't have the time to run around from audition to audition trying to land roles, so he started producing his own shows. It's a similar story for the founders of the 11th Hour Theater Company. Michael Philip O'Brien, Megan Nicole O'Brien, and Steve Pasek started this company, which specializes in musical theater, in 2003. The trio wanted a platform for presenting their own work and more creative control over the shows they're in. Steve Pasek says that one key to a startup is knowing the landscape of the local theater scene.
You know, when you're bringing something new, you want to make sure that you're filling a void. It's something that we definitely thought about. There was an opening for us to kind of fill in the gap.
Pasek says that other than the Prince Music Theater and occasional shows from the Arden, the Philadelphia Theater Company, and the Walnut, there isn't a lot of musical theater happening in the region. And because 11th Hour is much smaller than these other companies, with less resources, the type of musicals it performs are very different from what the Prince or Walnut will do. 11th Hour has its niche, while Luna Theater founder Gregory Scott Campbell agrees that finding an identity is important. He cautions that a developing company shouldn't limit itself too much.
If you're going to have a limiting mission statement about what you're trying to produce, that know that you're going to have a limiting effect on attendance.
Campbell says a company can't and shouldn't try to be everything to everyone. But if you're dedicated to only doing, say, Stephen Sondheim musicals, the growth of your audience base will be restricted. And one of the top priorities for a young theater is to find a large core of faithful patrons. With all the new theaters that have emerged in recent years, a question that frequently comes up is whether or not the region is close to having too many theaters. Jennifer Childs, founder and artistic director of 1812 Productions, an all-comedy theater started 10 years ago, says while she doesn't know if Philadelphia is close to a saturation point, companies do need to be tapping into new audiences.
Because I do feel at times that there's a sort of fight for the same audience members. And I feel like there has to be a sort of larger overarching mission for everybody to kind of say, how do we expand that audience in general?
And the logic goes, the stronger the community as a whole, the more people are going to be interested in theater. Yet the issue of a saturation point isn't just about attendance. Like any business, money is needed to run a theater company, and ticket sales alone rarely cover the expenses. Corporate support and grants from foundations and the government are essential. Michael Philip O'Brien of the 11th Hour Theater says competition for funding has increased in recent years.
I think the process has definitely become more selective because they have a lot more groups that are applying.
The tricky part is, until a company has been around for a while and has a proven track record, foundation support and government grants are usually not available. So a young company needs to somehow generate attention, catching the eye of audiences and theater critics, to set it apart from the other small and new companies in the crowded field. For some theaters, this means producing as much work as possible so that as many people as possible become familiar with the company. Michael Philip O'Brien says his 11th Hour Theater didn't take this approach, though.
I would rather do one show and do it really well than try to produce too many things in one year and spread out the money and spread out the talent.
It seems that the 11th Hour's focus on quality over quantity is paying off. Last season, they produced one main show, The Bombity of Errors, and recently garnered two Barrymore Theater Awards for it. O'Brien says this recognition has helped make 11th Hour more legitimate in the eyes of funders. New doors for grants and support are now opening. But even when the funding component of starting a theater starts to come together, there are a host of other concerns to consider. Marketing strategies, building the company's infrastructure, paying actors, finding a safe, accessible, and affordable space to rehearse and perform in. It's a complex undertaking that requires a lot of planning and creativity. But 1812 Artistic Director Jennifer Childs says there is a simple part.
You have to program what you're passionate about and do it to the best of your ability. And if you're true to that, I feel like people will connect to it.
It remains to be seen whether or not Philadelphia's theater boom over the last decade will continue, and if all the recent startup companies will even survive in the long run. But amid a flurry of activity, passion for theater among new Philadelphia companies is one thing that's not lacking.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's our show. Our thanks this week to Elizabeth Flynn, Norman Keyes, Tyler Melchior, Catherine Blodgett, and Ron Clem. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.